first order, and we will open with a public hearing on Senate Bill 56. And I'll have staff introduce.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 56 creates a planning and advisory committee on the promotion of financial education and financial self-sufficiency. It currently sunsets the planning and advisory committee on June 30th of 2005 and declares an emergency effective on passage. This bill currently has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. However, I am aware that some of the proponents are probably going to suggest a couple amendments that might take care of some of these issues.
All right. I call Janet Carlson and Floyd, is it Lauder?
I've got several people.
All right, you bring them up. You bring them up and announce them in the order
that
you...
We were on the work group. I was thinking maybe we just have that come together.
Okay.
Okay. I'll move over when I can trade with me. Oh, and...
You're an old hand at juggling chairs, aren't you?
They have to make sure they're not caught at the bottom. Chair Fisher, members of the committee, I'm Janet Carlson, Marion County Commissioner, and wanted to thank you for hearing Senate Bill 56 today. Every bill has a story, and I'm going to tell you the story behind this bill, and then I've brought some people from the work group to talk more explicitly about the issues. Last session, when I was a representative here from House District 20, there was a bill that came before Senator Fisher's committee from the State Commission on Children and Families to delete a portion of statute that had never been implemented in the enabling statutes for the State Commission on Children and Families, and that was around children's development accounts. It wasn't that the State Commission on Children and Families believed that children's development accounts weren't a good idea. It was simply that they didn't have the staff or the apparatus to handle such accounts, and these had been on the statute books for about 10 years. I opposed the bill, actually blocked the bill, because I know how hard it is once something is eliminated from statute to get it back if it's a good idea, and had proposed moving it to Housing and Community Services, where they administer already individual development accounts, and so this would broaden it from simply individuals to families. Through a process, I believe we had a bill, and it moved to the Ways and Means Committee, or there may have been an amendment to a bill or whatever, and through a communication glitch amongst staff and the chair of the Ways and Means Subcommittee, the bill did not pass out of Ways and Means at the end of session last time. So I took it upon myself to pull together a work group to look at what we could do in the interim and bring something back to session this time. What was interesting to me in looking at this issue was that in addition to the individual development accounts through Housing and Community Services and the children's development accounts that had never been created in the State Commission on Children and Families, there were training accounts in the Department of Human Services and what was then called Adult and Family Services. There were microenterprise networks and in statute through Economic Development Department. We passed a refundable child care credit during the last session. We have been looking at credits for long-term care insurance for seniors. We have the Oregon College Savings Account through the State Treasurer's Office, and it seems that like we have a number of different programs spread across state government in different agencies, relatively small programs designed around a similar intent, and that is to encourage people to save or develop assets or become financially literate, if you will, the ability to handle their money and to invest their money well. Some of these programs are designed for people who are poor. Some of them are designed for people who are of any income, as the Oregon College Savings Account. As a work group, and you've gotten a handout, you should have that before you, that lists the people who participated in the work group. We identified a number of policy issues, and then we also identified what we called some administrative issues. So one of our questions was, do we need legislation to move this forward, or can we simply do some things through the various agencies to better coordinate? We shared information with each other, and as often happens when you bring people from different agencies together, there were some surprises. Oh, I didn't know you did this. Oh, I didn't know you did that. When we got to a point of trying to determine what a bill might look like, we really determined that what we needed was continued discussion among the groups. And then, of course, we were in the midst of special sessions at that point and realizing that the revenue situation in the state of Oregon was rapidly changing and not, you know, knowing where that was going to end, decided that there wasn't any point really in trying to come up with something concrete at this stage. We crafted the bill to create a planning and advisory committee. It's modeled after a bill that I did last session, Senate Bill 133, that created a planning and advisory committee in the Department of Corrections about children of incarcerated parents. The concept was that the fiscal impact would be minimal, that the state agencies that have the programs would work together, that they would each in-kind contribute to the costs that might be associated with the agency. And, for example, if a banker were chosen to serve on this planning and advisory committee and give his expertise, his or her expertise, the treasurer's office has funding where they can supply travel expenses to people that are in that realm. If someone from a community action agency were to be a representative, Housing and Community Services have funds that can provide travel costs for those types of representatives, so that the treasurer and Housing and Community Services department director would be strategic, if you will, about who they selected to serve on the committee, so that they'd have a good representation and yet at the same time could use funds that are already dedicated for those types of purposes. So you have the summary before you. I've also attached some handouts that talk about the issue of development accounts and financial literacy. And and the last thing before I turn it over to the remainder of the work group is that in discussing then where we're at this time, we're proposing several amendments, and I made a separate handout this morning of those. We had anticipated that there might be some budgetary impacts during the next session, and so I had talked with Marjorie this morning and suggested maybe changing one of the lines, and Marjorie, I'm not going to do that one anymore, so you notice one of them is missing. So we start with page 3, line 16, which allows the Planning and Advisory Committee to wait and submit its final recommendations in 2006 rather than 2004, so it just stretches it out for a couple extra years, and that allows us, again, to kind of stabilize and see where we're at. On page 3, line 25, we want to make sure that Housing and Community Services does not have to provide staffing for the group beyond what their funding will allow. And then, so we've made subject to the availability of funds. And then finally, since we had moved the recommendations out to 2006, we would repeal the section of the Act in 2007 rather than 2005. So those are the three amendments that we're proposing to the bill at this point. And then we'll see if there are others in the discussion today. So with that, I'll turn it over to David Foster from Housing and Community Services. Thank you.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm David Foster. I serve as a policy strategist at Oregon Housing and Community Services. As Janet said, I also represented the department on the working group, the interim working group that she chaired over the past year. The value of a coordinated and strategic state financial education initiative for Oregon is hardly arguable. I brought along just a little example for you. Last week in the New York Times, headline, Home Equity Borrowing Rises to Worrisome Levels. Americans are borrowing against their homes at unprecedented levels, leading some bankruptcy lawyers and consumer advocates to warn that many people could wind up losing their homes. Homeowners raised $130 billion last year through home equity loans and lines of credit, nearly double the total a year earlier, according to the Federal Reserve. And as long as their home values rise, borrowers who are having trouble making their payments can take out further loans or can sell their houses for more than they owe. Indeed, people have not fallen behind on their home equity loans nationwide in troubling numbers. But in parts of the Midwest and the Southeast, where home prices have softened, delinquencies on home equity debt have started to rise, and bankruptcy lawyers are reporting that a growing number of clients are losing their homes to the banks. I'm representing a large number of newly homeless people, said Barbara May, a bankruptcy lawyer in St. Paul, Minnesota. Many of these people have taken home equity loans in addition to their existing mortgages. We're just buried in foreclosures, she said. Bankruptcy lawyers warned that the problem could spread to other parts of the country if home prices soften or if the economy does not improve. Whether one considers the average personal credit card debt per household, which I believe is around $8,000, the record number of bankruptcies, the spending patterns of teens, or the abysmal estimates of the percentage of baby boomers that are prepared financially for their sunset years, which, if I'm remembering correctly, is somewhere around 15%, Americans and Oregonians are not accepted could really benefit from a good dose of financial education. The social consequences of our citizens not approaching their family economies in a thoughtful, responsible manner are huge. Senate Bill 56 provides a purposeful general outline of how the state might begin to study and focus attention on this critical issue. The bill presents an ambitious expectation of producing final comprehensive recommendations to this long-standing issue in a little more than a year. The amendments stretch that out a bit. Even figuring out a few appropriate strategies and initiatives in a year would probably be an ambitious undertaking to coordinate those across all state agencies. We at the department are also very anxious that the bill presumes we'll be able to staff the initiative without new funding or staffing. It's a new initiative. It will require considerable research and development and interagency coordination. It expects and needs support from several other agencies at a time when state government can hardly accomplish what's mandated in statutes. So we really, if you proceed forward with this bill, the amendments that Ms. Carlson has suggested would be very much helpful in the process.
And used ones.
We assuming a quarter of an FTE for the year as a conservative estimate of what facilitating this, bringing people together might involve, you're looking at pushing a $50,000 price tag. So OHCS is in the uncomfortable position of fully supporting the worthy initiative outlined in Senate Bill 56 while not being fully supportive of creating a new initiative without sufficient staffing and funding fulfilled the expectations. If you're able to identify additional funding to support it, we feel that this would be an incredibly purposeful initiative.
David, do those home equity loans include the reverse mortgages that...
I don't remember them saying that but I know from other materials that that is a big issue out there as well, that's beginning to become an issue because people outlive the value of their equity in the mortgages. So you're right. Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
Anything else that I can respond to? Thank you.
Thanks, David. For the record, my name is Michael Parker, the Executive Director of the Oregon College Savings Plan, and I, too, served on the work group that Janet put together to look at some financial literacy issues. Just really briefly, the Treasurer has always been very interested in financial literacy and trying to figure out how to get financial literacy down to all Oregonians. We have a vehicle now through the Oregon College Savings Plan to achieve just this goal, using this vehicle to do financial literacy. The Treasurer has an internal mandate to do financial education, and he really wants to try to use the Oregon College Savings Plan to teach financial literacy. So last session, we actually connected the Oregon College Savings Plan to some IDA legislation that made it very beneficial for folks of the lower economic means to use IDAs and save for college through the Oregon College Savings Plan. So it's been a very nice partnership. Actually, David helped out quite a bit with that. So really, our message is we have a vehicle to use to get financial literacy out to Oregonians, and through the College Savings Plan. As most folks know, next retirement, college savings is the next largest worry that parents and grandparents have for their kids and grandkids. So if we can get that message out to Oregonians, save for college, but also then teach them financial literacy at the same time, be a very big benefit.
My name is Bill Goldsmith, and I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Microenterprise Network, and I'm also Board Chair of OUR Federal Credit Union in Eugene, which is a community development financial institution with 2,000 members serving Lane County. I'll make my remarks brief, but my full testimony is in front of you. Recently, there's been a growing emphasis on family assets as a better measure of poverty than income, and there's been a concurrent development of programs that help families build assets as a more lasting solution to poverty. Household assets translate to economic security, mobility, and opportunity for families in this arena, and Oregon's been making some important progress. As a result of past policy actions of the legislature and also efforts of community-based programs, Oregon recently made the honor roll on the State Asset Development Report Card issued by the Corporation for Enterprise Development, placing third among all states. This means that relative to other states, more Oregon residents hold some assets and have financial safety net, and that there are significant policies in place to support gains in this area. However, as much as we might congratulate ourselves on these achievements, the fact is that nearly one quarter of Oregon's families live in asset poverty, meaning that they're without sufficient net worth to subsist at a poverty level for 3 months without other support, and a third of our citizens don't have the opportunity to build wealth in the form of home equity. Over the past decade, a number of community-based responses to the issue of asset poverty have emerged. Individual development accounts, financial literacy programs, microenterprise development activities, home buying programs, and other efforts are supporting existing state policies to assist low-income Oregonians reach self-sufficiency. The programs that I'm speaking for today are involved in two efforts around asset development, and there's more information in my testimony about those. As we all sift through competing strategies in this time of extraordinary fiscal restraint, asset building emerges as an increasingly sensible choice for public investment. There's growing evidence that even a small amount of assets in the form of savings, home equity, business ownership, or human capital is critical to the well-being of lower-income families. The benefits of asset ownership seem to translate into Oregonians spending less time cycling on and off various public assistance programs and more time spent as wage earners, consumers, and productive members of the state's economy. The creation of a planning and advisory committee to promote the use of asset-building strategies as envisioned by SB 56 can be a tremendous help in consolidating and furthering existing state policies and community efforts in this area. Oregon needs a way to integrate and coordinate state-administered efforts to help its lower-income citizens build their wealth. Your support of this bill would be an important step in achieving this result. Thank you.
Yes, Senator Morissette.
Thank you. Bill, you've made significant headway in helping low-income people get away from the predatory lending practices of the car title companies and so on. Is that...
We're certainly trying. Significant would be overstating maybe of our accomplishments, but we have a financial literacy program currently operating in Lane County. Mm-hmm. Last year we provided education for over 200 low-income families.
And you're located in a low-income area.
We're located in the Whitaker neighborhood of Lane County and of Eugene, and provided them with a number of tools to avoid using predatory lenders and payday lenders and other organizations that exploit low-income families.
Good. Thank you.
Sure.
Good job.
Thank you very much. I have a Floyd Lanter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, they didn't make more specifically the people who are most susceptible to that.
Janet wants to get these drawn up.
Yeah.
Go ahead, sir.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chairman Fisher and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Floyd Lanter. I'm the administrator for the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities. We're a member of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. I'm here this afternoon to provide the committee some information on the department's interest in this initiative, Senate Bill 56, and of the department's resources which may be applicable or of value to this initiative. DCBS supports the concept of increased financial education, which this bill will promote. Financial literacy education is a vital tool in our efforts to support the availability of a wide range of financial services, protect consumers, and prevent and prosecute financial fraud. The range of agencies and community entities represented on this committee created by this bill and the sponsorship of the bill by the Joint Interim Committee on Health and Human Resources suggest a broad common interest that we support.
We were not aware of the interim committee's deliberations and therefore not included as a member of the Planning and Advisory Committee created by this bill. We only learned about it when it was published. DCBS can provide significant resources and partnership in the effort to promote financial literacy. The department's Division of Finance and Corporate Securities is the regulator of state chartered banks, state chartered credit unions, payday and title loan companies, mortgage lenders, consumer finance companies, the securities industry, endowment, care and funeral trusts, and other programs. Finance and Corporate Securities administers the investor education program and is a partner with federal regulators and stakeholders, which provide financial education resources such as the Money Smart program of the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. Through our website and publications, we place a range of information in the hands of investors and consumers of financial services to help them navigate the very real pitfalls of the financial and investment world. Senate Bill 56 also does not include the insurance division of the Department of Consumer and Business Services on the advisory committee. The charge of the committee under Section 1 includes insurance and risk management as aspects of financial education. Our interest is in assuring that you have an opportunity to employ the department's expertise in automobile, health, Medicare supplement, long-term care, homeowners credit, and life insurance. The insurance division also actively advises and informs consumers in its administration and enforcement of the insurance code. In summary, DCBS supports financial education and favors the general concepts expressed in this bill. We recommend that Section 1 of the bill be amended to include on the Planning and Advisory Committee one member who represents the Department of Consumer and Business Services, appointed by the Director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. Thank you for allowing me to testify. I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Would you want to get more specific and require that that be somebody out of the corporate securities, finance and corporate security?
Chair Fisher, I think I'd leave that up to the director. We actually have two divisions that have programs that apply here, so whatever she sees fit, we really don't need to be specific about it.
Commissioner Carlson, would you come and speak to this?
I was just telling Mr. Parker that usually people are trying to get out of my bills, not going to them. So this is a welcome amendment. We're open to, you know, whatever the department, if they're anxious to participate, we're happy to accommodate. So however you want to.
Could you then work on that and these other amendments?
Right. We'll work with Marjorie on that.
All right.
Would be fine.
I'll get those drafted for you.
Looks like you've answered all the questions. Is there anyone else that wished to testify? Thank you, Mr. Lander. We appreciate you coming. Seeing no one, I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 56 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 718.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, Senate Bill 718 appropriates money from the general fund to DHS for the provision of child care assistance to low-income post-secondary students and is currently effective July 1st of 2003 after declaring emergency. This does have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. However, attached to the staff measure summary, you do have the Dash 1 and Dash 3 amendments, one from Ringo's office and one from community colleges. However, we just received Dash 2 amendment, hopefully from Senator Ringo's office, and lo and behold, there he is.
Senator Ringo, do you wish to come up and occupy the hot seat for a moment or two?
The cooler seat.
Watch you right in a minute.
Senator Fisher, members of the committee, for the record, Charlie Ringo, Senate District 17. Senate Bill 718 is all about getting education to young people so that they can improve their lives and contribute to society. We originally offered the bill asking for money from the state. We decided that that wasn't likely to go very far. So the amendments allow for the program to continue, hopefully so that it can receive federal money, so the program stays alive, even though the state might not be contributing any money at all. You know, for me, education is the most important thing a person can have. And study after study shows that somebody's income level through life is really tied to their education. And I think it is a real tragedy when somebody is prevented from obtaining a quality education because of their family circumstances, because they have young children, and because daycare is so expensive. And so this bill is intended to allow for grants to young people so that they can obtain daycare for their children so that they can obtain higher education and improve themselves. So really appreciate your close consideration of this bill. Be happy to answer any questions.
Okay, I'm trying to get all sorted out here because I think we've got a mistake here when we had the -3 amendments drafted. We got it back into the Department of Human Services, and the other two amendments take it out of the Department of Human Services and put it over in the Employment Department, Child Care Division, Employment Department. So I think we've got a bit of a...
Yeah, Senator Fisher, frankly, I haven't seen any -3 amendments, but I would encourage you to ask some of the students that have really put their energies into this, the details on that. My understanding is that they do want it in the Employment Department, but that's secondhand, and I would just encourage you to ask the students, because they'll give it to you firsthand.
Well, I think so. The -3 amendments delete the $1 million and allow it to utilize federal funds as they are available.
Which is the goal.
It keeps it open, at least. And I think it was just in talking with briefly prior to the meeting today, I think it just was an error that we just didn't get them to follow through on the -3 amendments.
Okay.
So it looks like we're going to be slowed down a bit here, but I thank you for the work you've done on the -2.
Well, thank you, members of the committee.
Thank you very much. We have Kristen Wallace and Rachel... Okay. Rocky Dallum, Bratton Cairns, and perhaps that will fill the chairs, at least for the moment. Go ahead.
Okay. For the record, I'm Kristen Wallace, Chair Fisher and members of the committee. Once again, Kristen Wallace. I am an Oregon Student Association board member, student body president at Portland State University, and a mother of kindergartner Dominique. I'm speaking in support of Senate Bill 718. Once again, thank you for allowing me to speak about the Child Care Block Grant. The Student Child Care Block Grant has been a source of extreme relief for me. After waiting 15 months to receive the grant and taking out thousands of dollars in loans to cover child care costs and frantically borrowing money from my single mother, I finally received the grant. However, just after 4 months of receiving the grant, in the fifth special session, the grant was then cut, and I received notification that obviously the program was cut, and the funding for Dominique's child care would end. I am fortunate enough to get a scholarship for after school care, and this allows me to attend school while Dominique is cared for at the community center. However, the center was closed last week due to budget cuts, and staff has been cut as well. Today, I'm fortunate enough to have the support of my family, and I live with my family, in fact, and this has definitely lessened the burden on me. But while I'm lucky, many families in the state of Oregon are not as fortunate as myself. But really what this program is about the future of Oregon, and this is about our economy, and this is about our children. Today, I keep my chin up, and I keep fighting. And I want my daughter to know the value of education. I really think that she sees that. And in fact, my daughter spent 2 days last week, it was her spring break, down here in Salem. And she spent hours as a 3-year-old, as a 4-year-old, as a 5-year-old, and now as a 6-year-old here in Salem. advocating for her future. And today, as I pulled away from her elementary school in Portland, she knew that I was off to come talk to you folks, and she was definitely cheering me on, and she stayed behind. She's performing in her first musical and getting ready for her first speaking role, so very exciting news. But really, I'm here to testify for this program. I'm here to defend it, the future of Oregon and families across the state, so of course my daughter can have the opportunity to go to college and be a productive member here in society. And there's also, as you folks might know if you've looked through some of the information, there are over 1,300 families waiting for this support. So it's about creating self-sufficient families, strengthening them, and by doing this, you're building community, our economy, and allowing children to have educated parents, and this perpetuates the cycle of success. So I urge you to look ahead, to prioritize families, and consider Oregon's future. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Chair Fisher, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Rachel Pilliard, and I'm the student body president at the University of Oregon and also the chair of the Oregon Student Association. Today, I am also speaking in support of Senate Bill 718 and the hundreds of families that will benefit from the restoration of the student child care block grant. Too often, student families are forced to choose between providing care for their children or receiving an education. The rising cost of attending post-secondary education and the expenses related to securing quality childcare often prevent student parents from getting a degree and increasing their financial stability. The state's response, especially during the budget crisis, has largely been a trade-off, suggesting that student parents pay out of post-secondary education, post-secondary education, and receive child care benefits through state welfare programs. The Student Child Care Block Grant is a solution to these problems. It increases access and affordability to education, it reduces reliance on public assistance, and it creates social and economic returns for the state. Investing in student parents has many long-term benefits. Workers who receive a bachelor's degree earn up to 75% more than workers with a high school diploma. Children who receive quality child care generate $3 to $7 for every dollar invested. Children whose parents receive a college diploma are more likely to pursue one themselves and will have higher lifetime earnings, lower rates of unemployment, fewer teen pregnancies, lower crime rates, and fewer incarcerations. Assisting student parents is a short-term investment with many long-term returns. Restoring the Student Child Care Block Grant is important to students and to the state. Oregon, more than ever, needs an educated workforce. High unemployment rates signal an increased number of displaced employees and out-of-work families. There is a larger number of Oregonians looking to get a better education and once again become financially independent. This program will help them achieve that goal. Less than a year ago, there were over 2,000 families either receiving the grant or on the waiting list. While the state could only serve a fraction of that population, the demand for this program is continuously growing. Currently, there is no state support for student parents looking to secure quality child care. The Student Child Care Block Grant is essential for students, their children, and for Oregon. In these difficult budget times, it is important that we restore the program with or without immediate funding so that when monies become available, we can help educate more Oregonians and provide a better future. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Rachel, in your introduction, you left out one of the most important...
The most important thing, yes. I forgot to mention that I am a proud graduate of Thurston High School from Springfield, Oregon.
That gives you credibility before
Indeed.
This committee.
Mr. Chair?
Thank you. Rocky?
Mr.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes.
Did you ever have a Mr. Roush as your teacher?
Yes, I did.
He's my nephew.
Oh, really?
No,
you know Morgan Roush?
Turned out so well.
Oh. See? There you have it.
You struck the right notes. Rocky.
Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Rocky Dahlem. I'm the legislative director for the Oregon Student Association, and I'm going to speak briefly about the history of the Student Child Care Block Grant. The Student Child Care Block Grant was implemented in 1991 following a federal block grant called the Child Care and Development Block Grant. The Department of Human Services and an interagency task force was charged with finding different target populations to use on the Child Care and Development Block Grant, and one that they chose was student parents, and that's when they created the Student Child Care Block Grant.
$1.5 million was used to fund the program, and an additional $0.4 million, or $400,000, for the Student Child Care Block Grant. Through the mid-90s, there was a number of discussions on where the program would best fit, either between Adult and Family Services and Department of Human Services, or the Child Care Division of the Employment Department, since the Child Care Division received the original block grant. In February of 2002, in 2001, the state finally put $1 million of support and increased the federal funding to 2.3, funding the program at 3.3 million. But in February of 2002, $1 million was cut from the program, leaving approximately 360 families still served. In the third special session, another $1 million was cut. In April of 2002, students were notified that funding may not be available through the summer term. Finally, last fall, students were notified that the program would officially be ending at the end of September. When the program was eliminated, there was still 181 families receiving the grant, and over 1,700 were on the waiting list. Currently, the program is no longer in existence, and there is no availability of federal funds without the program in a budget. So, thank you. I'm willing to answer any questions regarding the Dash 2 amendments as well.
Okay. Did you have a preference as to whether the money should be in the Human Services budget or the Employment Department budget?
Yes, and that's what the Dash 2 amendments actually do. The program had been, in 99, they officially placed it in Adult and Family Services, the Department of Human Services, and unfortunately our bill didn't reflect that. We didn't have time to go back to LC and change it, so we were going to amend it back to the Employment Division. So what we're trying to do is place the program in the Child Care Division right now.
And to follow up, Mr. Vice Chairman, what is your reason for favoring that program, that department, over Human Resources?
Senator Burdick, in discussions with both Department of Human Services and the Child Care Division, both of them have recommended that it's a better fit in the Child Care Division. Department of Human Services has mentioned that it might not exactly fit their mission because it's not aimed at helping working families get back to work, but it's more a student-oriented program and focuses on child care directly.
Okay, thank you very much.
Senator Brown.
Thanks. Kristen, I was fortunate enough to have the opportunity to teach at PSU about a year and a half ago, and I was surprised because my class it was a very small class, only 12, but about half were parents, and I don't know that all the parents are eligible for the block grant, and I was just curious if any of you know how many of the students that are in our university system are parents, not just those that are eligible for the block grant programs.
I couldn't tell you statistically, but at Portland State, we have a significant number of non-traditional students, and that's why access to higher education is so important, particularly in an urban setting. And so I can tell you that I know for Portland State, we do have a significant number of student families, but I couldn't tell you exactly how many. But I could look into that for you.
Okay.
If you're interested.
Vice Chair Morissette, Senator Brown. At the University of Oregon, we have a program that students have initiated that provides some child care coverage through our own incidental fee process, mm-hmm. and there are 200 families currently served by that program. It's full at max capacity.
Oh, okay. Thanks.
Good. Thank you. Other questions? Thank you. Grant and Cairns and Julie Sahanek.
No.
Oh. And Chancellor Jarvis as well.
Kind of walk on addition. If you
a walk on is fine. Off is fine.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, for the record, Grant and Cairns, Director of Government Relations for the Oregon University System, here in support of the students in reauthorizing and finding an appropriate home for the Child Care Block Grant. The system has been supportive of the appropriation in the past and has testified in favor of it and has been supportive of this program. The board, the State Board of Higher Education, has four chief goals: access, quality programs, efficiency, and employable graduates. The access is the critical one, and the chancellor has asked if he could come along and speak for just a minute about the access issue.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Richard Jarvis, Chancellor of the Oregon University System, and grateful for an opportunity to speak in support of SB 718 and in support of the Child Care Block Grant. The issue, I think, fundamentally is one of affordability, It's a dimension on which we as a state are struggling enormously at the present time. As you know, we received an F grade in the latest national report on affordability, and that speaks directly to all of the expenses that students incur, not just those of tuition, but those of other support services in which the category of childcare ranges very, very highly. The tragedy of this kind of problem is that it suppresses demand. For many of the parents, the young parents who will be denied access to our institutions because of lack of this support, they will not show up on any of our statistics. They won't be there as someone who applied and was denied entry. And so we can report that to you as someone who was denied access. They simply will disappear and not be able to gain access. And it is that suppression of access which I think is one of the most insidious things afflicting our state at this time. Access delayed is indeed access denied, and anything you can do to help support this very critical population would be immensely valuable to us. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Okay. Julie.
Hi. Chair Morissette, I'm members of the committee. For the record, my name is Julie Sahonik. I'm with the Oregon Community College Association, and I'm here to testify in support of Senate Bill 718. We think that child care and post-secondary education merge two very powerful resources that promote the state economy. We think that by providing child care program assistance for student parents, that we are allowing them to become more successful in this knowledge-based economy that's growing here in Oregon. Just to get it on the record, nationwide, the average student child care costs range about $4,000 a year. And as we see in Oregon, the rising tuition costs here, that's becoming a high dual financial burden for many Oregon student families. And we think that this bill will go a long ways in helping to assist those student families attain the post-secondary education that they want. I also want to make sure that the committee is aware that we are supportive of both amendments, -2 and -3 amendments as well. I'd be happy to take any questions that you may have.
Okay. Questions?
I do, actually.
Yes, Senator Brown.
Julie, the -3 amendments delete, as I read them, the request for $1 million. And I guess my question would be, doesn't it make sense to at least send the bill with the $1 million request in it to Ways and Means and try and fight it out there as opposed to deleting the request at this point in time and hoping for the best? I mean, it doesn't make more sense to be more aggressive right now.
Chair Morissette, Senator Brown, I would agree with you that it would make sense, I think, in better fiscal circumstances to be more aggressive right now. I think that there is some concern of members of the Senate that this bill would not move forward with the $1 appropriation in the general fund because of wanting to commit that money. And so we wanted to pull that out and make the program available for federal funds now, and then as state funds become available, keep that program open to those. And we think that the most important thing is to get this into statute so that we can get a program going so we can start serving students as soon as possible.
Mr. Chair, can I follow up?
Yes.
And Grattan, you would agree with that, having served so many years in this building?
Madam Mr. Chair and Senator Brown, yes. Right now there is no program. It has been eliminated. We need to reauthorize it, place it in statute, give it an appropriate home, allow it to take and disperse the federal funds available, and from that platform return for an appropriation later, as opposed to losing the bill, losing the program, lost from memory, and having to go back and start all over again from square one.
Okay. Senator Burry.
Thank you. So I'm hearing you correctly. All three of you agree that it doesn't matter to you whether it's in human resources or the employment department?
Chair Morissette, Senator Burdick, yes, it does matter. We do agree with what the legislative director from the Oregon Students Association did say. We think that it is a better fit in the Employment Department's child care division. We think that it's a secure fit and a long-term fit, and that is it will give it a chance to grow with the students that will apply to that program. We think that we agree that we have heard same thing in terms of the Department of Human Services, having some concern whether or not it matches their mission. Mm-hmm. And in talks with both departments, and with us, we all agree that this is the best fit for it.
Thank you for that clarification.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, can I clarify which amendment we're really going to look at eventually? That we have the -2 and the -3, and my understanding is you probably want both of those put together, and then the -3, what we need to do is take DHS out and insert Child Care Division and the Employment Department. So again, we'll draft one final amendment with -2, -3, everything focusing on the Child Care Division.
right?
Yes.
Okay.
Just a question then.
Yes.
But that is there another vehicle for direct appropriation for the child care block grant out there?
Federal funds, right? They want to keep the program alive by putting money.
Should the legislature decide to put $1 million of state dollars into the child care block grant, is there a vehicle out there that we could use then to do that?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Brown, I believe the answer would be yes, and it would be the department's budget.
Thank you.
Okay. Other questions? Okay. Thank you. And we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 718 and open the public hearing on Senate Bill 606. Jamie Bloom.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 606 authorizes licensed dentists to administer local anesthesia for the purpose of permanent lip coloring and hair removal in the lip area under certain circumstances.
Thank you. And Sheila.
And members, in your packet, you do have an extensive bit of written material from Sheila Ahern.
Okay.
Good morning. Good afternoon, Senator Morissette and Senators. My name is Jamie Bloom. I've been an electrologist for the last 20 years and an Oregon licensed electrologist for the last 15. I am a member of the Health Advisory Council for Tattoo Artists and Electrologists and have been chairman for the last year. This bill, 606, represents that we would like licensed dentists to be able to use a local anesthesia for the purpose of numbing the lip area before electrolysis. The procedure is very sensitive, and each client has a different pain threshold. When I first became an electrologist in Oregon, dentists were allowed to administer this anesthetic. And then for some reason it was dropped out and they were not allowed to do it. I was president of the Oregon Electrology Association, Oregon Association of Licensed Electrologists, many years ago when the tattoo artist wanted to be licensed, and I helped pass a bill so that they became licensed. Last year, the tattoo artist made a bill so that dentists can use a topical anesthetic for the purpose of to do on the lip area so that they can perform tattooing of the lip area. And it was passed. Unfortunately, they did not put down the process of electrolysis at the same time. This is a local anesthetic that it's administered by injection. And the procedure done by the dentist, whether it be for lip tattooing or electrolysis in the lip area, is the exact same procedure. And what we would like to do is have this bill passed so that a licensed dentist can apply a local anesthetic to the area for electrolysis and for tattooing. All we're trying to do is change the last bill to include electrolysis. If you have any questions, I'd be more than happy to answer them.
Question?
I'm Sheila Ahern, immediate past president of the Oregon Association of Licensed Electrologists, and we have proposed this bill at the request of many clients who were disappointed in not being able to receive a numbing injection from the dentist, and also other electrologist members and non-members of our association who would like to have that option open to their clients again. We have topicals we could use in our office, and our equipment is fairly gentle, but there are situations that come up where the hair is extremely heavy on the upper lip, or right along the lip line where it's very sensitive, where the lip area that the nerve endings are very much the same as in any other part of the body. They're just closer together. And so for those clients who are just more sensitive than others, or have more work to be done, this would be a nice option for them. And if we could go ahead and have this bill passed, it would give the dentist the clarification too of being able to even treat their own patients. It's been a little hazy. If a person comes into a dentist that's unfamiliar to them is one thing, to go to their own dentist is another. But it would just eliminate any confusion. It would certainly be up to the dentist whether they choose to do this or not. But it would be in writing, and it would be very clear for them that they could proceed. We have some testimony in our packet. There are a couple of additional letters that came in later that might be separate as well as what is in our packet. And you may find a couple of charts in there that give you an idea of the area in of the hair follicle in relation to some of the nerve endings, affecting sensation, and why that's important to our request.
Thank you. I apologize for being out. The best laid plans of mice and men. We had a problem here with a bill coming up, and I was doing my best to get a couple of sides and to some type of workable agreement out here. And having been a bit knowledgeable of this subject from times past, I took the liberty of going out, and it wasn't as meant as a disrespect for you folks that are putting your testimony on record, and I appreciate it. And was there anyone else that wished to testify or any questions of these folks?
Yes, Senator Brown. Sort of my question, and it may show my ignorance in these issues, but is the bill? Are we going to be back here in 2 years? Are there some other techniques that we're not leaving out that we should be including? I mean, obviously the tattooing and then now the hair removal. Is there another I'm just sort of trying to think yeah. ahead, so we're not back here in 2 years trying to expand the dentist's ability to do this. I don't know.
Sandra Brown, I'm not aware of anyone. We would have asked to be included last session. It came up at the end of the session, I believe, and we weren't notified, or we would have tried to do this all at one time. I can't think of too many procedures that would need this sort of thing.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Moore.
We could ask that question to the Labor Commissioner who just walked in, if there are any other occupations who would be involved in this bill.
I mean, Mr. Chair, the one that came to mind was piercing.
Oh, all right. Piercing, this is slightly different than piercing, because we're doing what the dentist can, when they administer their local anesthetic, it's a very specific area, and it numbs the upper lip and lower lip. The tattooist is putting color into the skin. We're removing the hair above or below it. With a piercing, it's usually one spot, if that's what you choose to do. And usually they don't use topical anesthetics even when they do the eye or the nose or any other areas, because it's like by the time if they were going to administer an injection, the piercing of the needle is the same feeling as the piercing of what they're doing. The electrologists in the tattoo industry have worked very close to get licensing so that the patient or clients are protected against infections and so forth. In this situation, for myself, I do a lot of transgendered people, and the hairs are so close together and so thick, to apply the right amount of heat for the procedure, it's very sensitive. And many of my clients used to go and have a dentist give a local anesthetic, and of course now truthfully, I am not sure whether it's the American Dental Association or the Dental Association of Oregon has basically said they should not do this procedure. So, but they are now allowed to do it, the tattooing, because of the bill. And so we just want to be able to have, you know, our group do it.
There were, this was talked about at our advisory council meetings, which were combined with the permanent makeup tattoo people. And some of those, some of the people who are tattooists, in, you know, generically, are also body piercers. And I don't recall that there was any discussion among them, but they were attending this meeting, that they said, oh, maybe we should do that too. You know, they were members of their association that were present. And so if they haven't come forward to, for that, I just can't speak to, you know, for what they might need. But,
I guess, Senator Brown, I don't know how to answer all the future needs here at One Shop.
They have a body piercing program. It's not
I'm
a licensing
as bad as
program.
She is when I say One Shop.
Thinking of my stepchildren, Mr. Chair, I'm just thinking that maybe a little pain is sometimes good. So
for somebody else.
For somebody else, right.
Would it help if I said I went to high school in New York at Van Buren High School?
I'm okay.
Is anyone in the audience that wish to participate in this hearing? Seeing none, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 606 and open a work session on Senate Bill 606.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, I would move Senate Bill 606 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Brown moves that we send Senate Bill 606 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. With Senator Carter as a carrier. Is there any further discussion? Objections? Seeing none, will the clerk call the roll?
Senator Brown?
Aye.
Senator Burdick? Senator Farno?
Aye.
Senator Starr?
Aye.
Senator Morstead?
Aye.
Senator Fisher?
Aye. Motion carries, and Senator Carter will carry the bill, I hope.
Thank you on behalf of our association.
Thank you.
We will close the work session on Senate Bill 606, and we're next on. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2021. Our staff introduce the bill.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2021 decreases from $1 million to $250,000 the amount of capital or surplus required by a health care service contractor furnishing dental service or optometrical service. This decreases additional capital and surplus requirement for health care service contractors from $500,000 to $250,000. In your packet, you do have testimony from Cedric Hayden, who is on your list to testify. You also have a letter from Aaron Kelly Seal from the governor's office. And that's it.
Thank you very much. Cedric, do you wish to come and speak to the bill?
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman and committee members. Appreciate the opportunity to speak to you today. Want to discuss House Bill 2021, which corrects, I think, or attempts to correct, I think, an oversight in legislation passed by the 2001 legislature, and mea culpa, I was there too. What it does is set very, very, very high standards, a very high financial bar for small companies who might want to serve the underprivileged in the state of Oregon. Up until the 2001 session, in fact, until December 31, 2002, the fiscal requirements for a dental or vision company were $50,000, $50,000 in reserves. The 2001 legislature said that after this, you will need to raise that by a quantum jump to $1,550,000. $1,500,000 more. It's far too high a bar for small companies. The Robert Wood Johnson Foundation says that in Oregon currently there are 650,000 uninsured people without medical coverage, probably more without dental coverage, and the state of Oregon is just releasing $100,000 without any dental insurance. We feel that even at the $50,000 level, there were no defaults of a dental insurance company in the state of Oregon. All met their fiduciary responsibilities. At $1,550,000, there will certainly be no financial bankruptcies because no company will do that except the larger companies who are currently not serving the 650,000 people. There will be no small entrepreneurs. This is, House Bill 2021 is a bill that is good for the consumer and it is good for small business because it strikes a reasonable balance between the $50,000 previous and $1,550,000. It's a good bill. Now, one thing that is not understood, and I didn't understand it when I voted on the bill, is that the existing health service contractors were allowed 5 years to raise the $1,550,000. And they have raised it. And they are in business. But they're still not insuring 650,000 people. New companies coming in have to put $1,550,000 on the table today to apply for their certificate of authority. That's inequitable. That's protectionist. That is not a level playing field. I do not believe the governor's office understands this. I do not believe the insurance division understands this. I do not believe that the people who will testify in opposition to the bill after me understood this. I did not understand it until I opened discussions with the insurance division. I said, what is this? Why does one group have to come up with $1,500,000 when another group was able to come in? Truth is that $250,000 would be five times the amount of insurance reserves that we had until last session. It's far more than enough. Your total level of risk for dental insurance is $1,500 a year. Very low level of risk. And in order, we're putting such tight safeguards on the hen house that the hens aren't going to lay any eggs. If we require these kinds of huge reserves, little companies just aren't going to come, and those people are going to continue to go uninsured. And I know it's not incredibly important to many people, but this is something I've spent my life doing. Most of my life has been taking care of low-income dental patients, either in the U.S. or in the third world. And to me it's important, and to them it's important, because when the Health Services Commission went around the state and had hearings and said, what do you really value in health care? They said, we love our hospitals, we love our doctors, we've got to have our prescription drugs, and fourth, right after prescription drugs, we love our dentists. And the Health Services Commission had not anticipated that response. It's a very high level of trust and regard that people want those services. Well, where does dental care come in the level of in the spectrum of priority for health care? I can tell you, it comes number five. 5 out of 10. Because when the Health Services Commission prioritized their 750 item list of health services, the dental items were interspersed, 35 of them, as high as 300 on the list. If you average them, they were number 5. They were the 5th most important thing. So I say that this is a bill that should be passed. It's a good bill the way it's written. Some compromises would be possible. This is the best bill. This is the best permutation to allow a dental insurance company to open business with reserves of $250,000. Would be the best thing because you would get more companies operating, more people covered, very low level of risk. The insurance division feels that they need higher coverage. If they insist on $1,550,000, it's very unlikely that a small company will come into the market. You have my written testimony before you on your desk, so I won't go through that. Mr. Chairman, are there questions?
Senator Starr. Yes, Cedric, I believe you mentioned that under the $50,000 program previously that there was no failures. Is that correct?
Insurance division advises me that there has that there were no failures within their memory of a dental insurance company at the $50,000 level. Again, Senator Starr, because the risk is so low. It's such a low level of risk. And the dental insurance companies have been able to provide the services to those people they insure. Mm-hmm. Now, let me say this, that most people pay $40 or $50 a month for dental insurance. A small company who does not have to charge an exorbitant premium because of these very, very high security levels can come into the market for half that premium. And that may be what, that could be something that would make other companies nervous. There might be a level of competitiveness there.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Morrison.
Cedric, in the letter from the governor's office, it says that House Bill 2021 proposed to roll back important solvency requirements for the health care service contractors. Now, the health care service contractors refers to all health care.
When House Bill 2021 was drafted, there was a glitch that I agree should be corrected. If you have a copy of the bill, Madam Administrator, do they have a copy of the bill? Okay, on line 26 on page 1, there is a glitch. Health service contractors, and here we're talking about hospitals and major medical clinics and the big players, you know. They have to have two pockets of money. They have to have capital and reserves, capital and surplus of X dollars. Then they have to have a bond of X dollars. And then they have to have additional capital and surplus. Line 26 talks about the additional capital and surplus. What that says is when you first get your certificate of authority, you have to have $500,000 in other reserves, extra reserves. And they have to be stocks, bonds, liquid money. The minute you get your certificate of authority, you no longer need that. But you have to have it. In drafting this bill, we intended that would be $250,000 just for dental and vision. But inadvertently, it does apply to all the other providers. It really doesn't make any difference because they all have those already. They all have their certificate of authority, and they all have that $500,000. So it's sort of a moot point, but I have no objection to raising that back up to $500,000 for the hospital chains and just leaving it that way for the dental providers. Is that clear?
Well, that clarifies my question, yes.
Yeah.
Now, when did you... This passed the House, came out of the committee with a unanimous due pass. Did this come up in the House side? This
came up on the House. It's a House bill. It passed the House with a bipartisan majority of 39-21,
okay.
So
this question was dealt with on the House side.
This question did not come up on the House side. We discovered this passed the House committee with this in the bill, and we didn't recognize it. We didn't realize that it rolled back the additional surplus for the hospitals.
Well, I'll defer to the chair.
Senator Morrison.
No, go ahead. Are you recommending an amendment then, perhaps?
I'm certainly open to any amendments. I believe that some permutation of this bill would be in the public interest.
Yeah, I agree. I agree.
And I'm certainly open to amendments.
Well, I will defer to the chair, and I think we need to pass the bill, and if it takes an amendment to do it, I'd be very happy to give you an amendment.
Senator Brown.
Thanks. Senator, I guess, so let me hear from your perspective why we passed the bill 2 years ago.
I must have blinked my eyes because I should have been watching things that deal with dentistry. I missed it completely. We passed the bill 2 years ago for this reason, because under law up until then, I believe, and I'm sort of trying to remember the numbers, up until that point of time, dental insurance companies, of which there are half a dozen or so or more in the state, only needed reserves of $50,000. And hospitals only needed reserves of $1 million. One sick baby can eat up $1 million. That's a very low reserve for a hospital. So the insurance division said we should raise these, and rightly so, they raised the hospital to $2.5 million. That may be a little low for hospitals. But at the same time, they raised the dentist to $1.5 million. That's way, way, way too high, way out of sight. It's a fiscal bar to companies who might service low-income Oregonians coming into the market. So they did it with good intentions. They didn't have input from anybody, everybody. Certainly didn't ask me, and I was a dentist, and I was in the legislature. So they did it with, I think, limited input. They did have some input from some of the existing contractors, but they just raised the dentist too high. I think they hit the mark with the hospitals. I think that's okay. They just got the dental insurance companies just got caught up in the with the hospitals, just got woven in together.
So if you were going to have an amendment to this line 26, you would put back the $500,000 for the health care service contractor and then accept dental and optometry?
That's correct. I would reduce the additional capital reserves only for optometrics and dentistry, and I would leave the $500,000 for everybody else, which they already have.
Thank you very much. We have a couple of three other folks here that wish to testify. Joel Ariel.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, Joel Ariel, Insurance Administrator with the Department of Consumer and Business Services. Let me start by saying I think that Cedric is very well intentioned in what he's proposing here. I have no quarrel with it, with the intention, and I hate to be up here as Dr. No, but that's what I have to be today. Let me start by clarifying a couple issues. First of all, the $50,000 number that was the starting point before 2001 did not apply to any actual healthcare service contractors in the marketplace, because there was a range from $50,000 to $500,000 depending on the size of the company, and there were no companies doing business at the bottom end of the scale. So all of the companies that were in the marketplace as of 2001 were well above the $50,000 number. In fact, I think they were all above the $500,000 number. We did at that time consult with all of the dental carriers that were active in the Oregon market. I think there were three of them, maybe four, and they all agreed to these new numbers because the numbers hadn't been changed in several years, and the numbers that we currently have are the numbers that are standard for other states, Washington, California, etc. This is what it costs to be in the insurance business. The $1 million number also isn't the number for the hospitals and the general health care service contractors. Their number is phasing into $2.5 million. So the limited healthcare service contracts, the dental and the optometry, are already 40% of what is standard for other healthcare business under this proposal. So again, what we did here was over time phase in numbers of $1 million for these limited carriers, and then $500,000 in additional capital. But that's necessary because if you start with just your surplus, then you go into business and you start doing business pretty quickly, you'll be below the surplus level as soon as you have to start paying claims. So those are the numbers, $1 million and $500,000. Now, we did talk to Mr. Hayden for quite some time back, I guess about a month ago, about whether we could apply those phase-in numbers to his business rather than have them meet the full requirement. Gave that a lot of consideration. We talked to people in the marketplace, and we looked at what's happening in the marketplace. What we found out was that there was one carrier, a dental carrier, who was below the $1 million number but was in the marketplace under the original numbers. Since the time of that bill, that carrier has decided to exit the market, not because of the capital and surplus, but because with limited capital and surplus themselves, they just can't make a business a go of it. The insurance business is not an easy business to make a go of it, and so we today only have carriers in this marketplace, which Mr. Hayden characterizes as the big guys, but they're actually fairly small, locally based companies. They're Oregon-based companies here that already all have above the $1 million in surplus, and that we think they really need that to do an effective job. The trade-off for you, and this is a decision that the legislature can make, is if you allow people in at lower numbers, you're going to get, over time, some number of bankruptcies. Those are very painful and difficult to deal with. It means that consumers get hurt. Oftentimes, it means that providers get hurt, and it means a lot of unnecessary expense on our part. We have to go in and hire a liquidator. We have to buy office space. We have to hire people to do legal and claims work on the cases, and it's just pretty much of a disaster when a company goes insolvent. I don't know if anybody's been involved in those. So that's why these numbers are set to try to avoid those situations. I will make one suggestion to the committee. If the Oregon Health Plan does allow people to come into the dental market and other markets, and a lot of the carriers, and I think this includes Mr. Hayden's proposal, are people who've been involved in the Oregon Health Plan side with thinner capitalization to provide services there. The difference is that the state of Oregon backs those plans. If anything happens to one of those plans, the state of Oregon takes care of the problem. We in the insurance division would be happy with this bill if the legislature wanted to say, we think these lower numbers are okay and we're confident there won't be bankruptcy, so we will put the general fund behind these claims so that if there is a bankruptcy and insolvency, the general fund will stand behind it. What is the problem for us is if we're told, set the limit so that you have enough money to handle the insolvency, and then we don't have enough money. That's the problem we face. So that it's a tough challenge. I think many of the points that Cedric makes are good points, but in the end, this is a bill that passed just last session. It passed, I think, almost unanimously. We did consult with everybody who was in the marketplace. Obviously, it's a little difficult to find people who weren't currently in the marketplace who might want to be, so we didn't consult with those folks, but we did consult with everybody in the marketplace, brought the legislature a consensus bill, and still, to my knowledge, we have now the one example of somebody who says this is a little too low. We're not seeing, there's not three or four or five or 10 entities out there who are saying we want to get in. There's just the one, and that's the situation we have. So with that, I'll stop and be happy to take any questions.
Senator Morissette.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Joel, were you involved in the, did you testify before the House committee when this bill was heard?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Morissette, no, I didn't. The story on that is that they scheduled that hearing on a one-day notice. My legislative guy didn't see it. We, when it passed the committee that day, it was work session. We went immediately to the chair, Representative Cruz, and told him that we were opposed to the bill, what had happened, and he agreed to put a memo. He asked us not to make an issue of it on the floor, and I think wrote a memo to Senator Fisher explaining that we had the opposition. So we essentially, rather than complicate the matter on the floor of the House, we decided to come over here to the Senate and put it in your lap. Sorry about that.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. You can handle it.
And the testimony is true that somebody cannot enter now without hitting the full maximum, regardless of the phase-in?
Mr. Chairman, yes, that's correct. If you look at the printed bill on page 3, starting section 6 on line 16, the phase-in applies to a health care service contractor that is authorized to transact services in this state on the effective date, December 31st, and that does not possess on January 1st the applicable capital and surplus. So it only applies to people who were in the market and didn't have the required surplus as of January 1st, 2002. And again, at that time there was one such dental carrier. Today there are zero in that category.
The one that stepped out, did state have to recover a bunch of money?
No, actually, they never even started writing commercial business, because as they looked at the marketplace, they decided that they couldn't make a go of it. One other issue I should mention here is that the concerns us about the phase-in, and if there were room for compromise here, I think that would be the place to compromise. So I don't want to draw an absolutely hard line on this, as we've talked about, but the one thing that does concern us is this: if somebody new comes into the marketplace now, I guess this year they'd come in with at least between 350 and 700, depending on the volume of business they do. They then would have to ramp up to the million over a fairly short number of years. And if they don't have the capital and surplus today, you got to ask yourself, where are they going to get it? The most likely answer will be through premiums. And so you're putting somebody in the marketplace who's probably going to have to increase premiums fairly quickly in order to survive. And so it's just a difficult business proposition, I think, is part of the aspect of this.
You know, the problem that I have, we've got a lot of people out there that need a lot of medical care. We're paying for that one way or another in the process anyway. If they're not getting the dental care, we're paying for it double, because they're winding up with a lot more expensive stuff than dental care, generally speaking, in the long run. It's, I guess, a little bothersome to me. It's nice to have big companies to do things. It's also nice to make arrangements to have a few other companies coming online from time to time. How many health-related insurance situations have you had to recover where you've had to go out and be the go-between, or spend a lot of your time and money on situations that have gone where somebody's gone broke or declared bankruptcy when they were an insurance company?
Chairman, we have not, thank God, had any insolvencies in the last decade or so. I think the last one was in 1990, maybe even 1989. But I do remember the quote from the current governor when that happened. It was a health company far west, and his quote was something on the order — he was insurance commissioner at the time — and his quote was something on the order of, you know, I've been swatting at gnats here in my office for a few years now, and now I've got a big elephant in the room. So when they happen, they're very, very difficult and very, very painful. And so we're proud of our record of not having that.
A lot bigger elephant in the room right now with the Oregon Health Plan.
Yeah, there are some elephants the governor is currently dealing with, I guess. But the job of being an insurance regulator is manageable in most respects, but when you get to a major insolvency, it becomes a very difficult proposition, because you have consumers, providers, other claimants, all of whom are extremely upset, all of whom have paid money in good faith on promises to achieve certain benefits, and when they don't get them, it's a very difficult. One other point I didn't mention that's important here: if this were a property and casualty company, there'd be a guarantee fund, too, to help out behind an insolvency, so that when somebody goes down, you can assess the rest of the insurance market. And that's also true for regular, not healthcare service contractors, but regular health insurers on the life and health side. For healthcare service contractors, there is no guarantee fund. There's something called the hold harmless, where the doctors are supposed to forego their payments in those sorts of situations, what's owed from the consumers. So that's supposed to operate as an alternative to the guarantee fund. But we don't have a guarantee fund to fall back on in these kinds of cases.
Yes, Senator Brown.
Are other states lowering capital requirements at this point in time for similar companies? What's happening in other states?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Brown, good question. No. States are generally increasing their capital and surplus. When we looked at it, our starting point was to try to look at particularly the western states and strike a balance, be in the middle somewhere of what other states were doing. And we hadn't raised our limits for some decade or so. So I don't know of anybody who has lowered limits in the last few years. I know of several states that have increased their limits.
Mr. Chair, follow-up.
Yes, Senator Brown.
So I don't know if I'm getting this right, but the companies that we had basically online for the bill, when the bill was passed, we sort of grandmothered them in, or they've come in slowly. Has anybody else come into the market other than this particular attempt? Has anybody come into the market since we passed the bill?
On the dental carrier side, I don't believe so.
Okay.
No, nobody's come in. I should note that there is another bill that's related to this in the legislative session, and I believe it's already passed the Senate, which is to take certain kinds of alternative health care and say that it's much closer to the dental and the optometry. That's Senate Bill 353, complementary health care, and allow them to have the $1 million limit that this bill has rather than the $2.5 million limit. And again, in that case, they are very limited, and so we were okay with that bill. We're not always Dr. No on these kinds of bills, but they did not make an issue of taking it down below $1 million. They simply wanted to be in the limited category rather than the general $2.5 million category.
Okay. Thank you very much. Have,
thank you.
Doug Barber and Russ House.
We can fight about that.
I know.
Since you're the grandfather on the committee, y'all. So I do think we have at least one grandmother on the committee. So,
Chair Fisher, members of the committee, my name is Doug Barber, here today on behalf of Willamette Dental Group. We're distributing a letter from Steve Petrozelli, who is the president of Willamette Dental Management Company. Willamette Dental, along with the other health carriers, were part of the process that Mr. Ario talked about last session, and we agreed to those levels at the time, thought they were adequate and sufficient, and continue to support them. With me today to discuss that is Russ House, the attorney for Willamette Dental.
Chair Fisher, members of the committee, we're here to support the Division of Insurance. We understand the dilemma of the concern about new entrants into the marketplace. But I think, as Mr. Ario testified, the carriers that were in the marketplace were not at the $50,000 level. There was one carrier back in 2001 that was seeking to get the phase in and then subsequently pulled out of the marketplace. And what we're finding in other states, we're in Washington and Idaho, is that the capital and surplus requirements are similar in nature, and the size of our company is considered small for an insurance company. And we're in Washington in the same situation, and we're at about the $1.5 million level for dental only.
Questions?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'm torn between people out there needing dental service and people that wish to make an attempt to provide it. And fairness, there's all kinds of issues involved here. And no, I think we'll go ahead and close our public hearings afternoon and continue to see if maybe we can strike some kind of a balance on this and work toward that in the future here, in the next few days. That'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2021 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 390.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 390 expands the types of organizations that may own or operate dental clinics or offices. It allows actively licensed dentists to be responsible for clinical practice of dentistry in a dental office or clinic. It requires retention of patient dental records and records of supervising dentists. And it allows certain fiduciaries for dentists or estate of deceased dentists to retain ownership interest in dental clinic or office for a limited period of time. Attached to the staff measure summary is a letter from Joanne Bones, who's the executive director of the Board of Dentistry.
Ooh, I think they're here for a week. Okay, I'm going to call Jane Myers. And if you have others that you'd like to bring, that's fine.
Mr. Chair, while they're coming forward, I have to say I've gotten more testimony on this bill than just about any other bill except for Senator Menace's, and I'm just really impressed that folks got so involved on both sides of the issue, so it's pretty amazing.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Jane Myers. I represent the Oregon Dental Association, and I'm mostly here today to try to facilitate the discussion from the Oregon Dental Association's point of view. I want to introduce Dr. Jay Wylam, who's a periodontist here in Salem. He's the chairman of our Government Relations Council. And Dr. James Fratsky, who is a retired dentist from Salem and is chairman of the Dental Association's PAC. So with that, I will turn it over to Dr. Wylam.
Thank you. Again, for the record, I'm Jay Wylam. I'm a member of the Oregon Dental Association and the chair of the Oregon Dental Association Government Relations Council. I'm speaking in support of Senate Bill 390. I think a very brief history of Senate Bill 390 may be helpful. As you know, the present Dental Practice Act states that all dental practices must be owned by a licensed dentist in the state of Oregon. There is one exception to this, and that is the Teamsters Clinic here in Salem. This has proven to be a problem for the Oregon Board of Dentistry to enforce the letter of the law, as there are licensed dentists practicing in public government clinics or in nonprofit clinics not owned by dentists. And examples of this would be the clinics at the Health Sciences University, Northwest Medical Teams Clinics, the Whitebird Clinic in Eugene, and various other nonprofit charitable-type clinics. In addition, the ODA members and the Board of Dentistry have also had concerns regarding the short-term ownership by spouses that is necessitated by a deceased practitioner and the fact that the spouse has to own the practice in transition to a new dentist. These issues were brought up by the ODA last session, and Senator Fisher suggested, and the Oregon Board of Dentistry requested that the Oregon Dental Association form a working group to address these issues. And the purpose of the working group was to bring all the interested parties to one table so that they could work out these issues. The working group met seven times over the past year, and I can tell you that the table was full. The table included the Oregon Board of Dentistry, the Oregon Dental Association, Northwest Dental Clinics, DenCor, Willamette Dental Group, Kaiser Permanente, Capital Dental, Northwest Medical Teams, the Health Sciences School of Dentistry, and Multnomah County Dental Clinic. Senate Bill 390 represents a consensus agreement of all of the interested parties that were at the table as part of the ODA working group. In summary, ODA asked for this bill in an effort to clean up the Dental Practice Act and to make sure dental clinics operated by charities, schools, and government were operating within the law. And they also wanted to allow temporary ownership by surviving spouses so that the practice can be transferred. Who benefits from this bill the people that benefit would include the School of Dentistry, local government clinics such as Multnomah County Dental Clinic, the community college dental clinics such as Mount Hood Community College, federally qualified health centers, nonprofit charitable dental clinics such as Northwest Medical Teams and Whitebird in Eugene. The patients of all of these clinics certainly benefit. The surviving spouses of deceased dentists will benefit. related businesses that employ dental hygienists and assistants and subcontract to dentists will benefit. Owners of real estate, furnishings, equipment, and inventory, all of the business aspects of dental clinics will benefit. Dental management businesses, and most importantly, the Board of Dentistry will benefit in that their application of the law will be more clear and more equitable in their ability to enforce the law. Again, Senate Bill 390 represents the consensus agreement reached by the dental community in a working group conducted by the ODA at the request of the Oregon Board of Dentistry. The ODA does understand that from the working group's meetings that a few of the parties, namely managed care dental care organizations, certainly wanted more than Senate Bill 390 gives. The ODA opposes adding any language to Senate Bill 390 that would open the door to corporate ownership of dental practices. Managed care organizations, insurers, and other corporate interests have House Bill 2964 in place to argue their cause, and this bill allows for up to 49% non-dentist ownership with no restrictions. I thank you very much for the opportunity to testify on behalf of the ODA, and would be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Yes, Senator Morissette.
You're opposed to House Bill 2964.
That's right, sir.
Because of that 49%, yes. Okay, so what you're saying is they've got a bill, and you don't want them to carry their argument into your bill. You want to keep them separate.
That's correct, sir. Okay.
Has House Bill 2964 had a hearing? Has it moved? Do we know? Okay. Good. Thank you. That's
Are there any more questions of the committee? We'd be happy to try to respond. Dr. Bratsky was up to act as a consultant.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
I had him down here to testify. So. Okay.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Senator Burdick.
I'm sorry I was late. This was not a good one to be late on. The Dental Association favors 390 and opposes House Bill 2021.
Right.
And the other one, 29 something or other, is in the House and has not had a hearing?
That's correct as far as I understand it.
Okay. We have Bob Porter from United Seniors. Wait a minute. Okay, we do have him. We'll do it after the show. Not today.
No, that House bill that we both signed.
Go ahead, sir.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Bob Porter. I'm president of the United Seniors of Oregon. Unfortunately, our legislative director, Jim Davis, couldn't be here today. He's in Washington, D.C. with the Alzheimer's Association. The United Seniors of Oregon and the Portland Gray Panthers and the other senior coalition want to express strong opposition to Senate Bill 390, which gives dentists almost unlimited ownership and control of dental offices or clinics. There is nothing more than a not-so-subtle attempt by the Oregon Dental Association to subvert the intent of Measure 24, which was passed by the Oregon voters in the 2000 general election by a 76-24 margin. Measure 24 states, quote, that a dentist, as defined in ORS 679.010, and a denturist may cooperate and maintain any business or professional association that is mutually agreeable with each being responsible for their respective area of expertise. ODA couldn't stop Measure 24 from establishing that denturists and dentists could enter into mutually beneficial business relationships. Now they want to undo it through Senate Bill 390, limiting dental business ownership to dentists and placing other severe restrictions that would allow for nearly complete dentist control. Through Measure 24, advocates strongly supported dentists and denturists developing strong collaborative relationships by removing barriers on the ability of denturists and denturists and dentists and denturists to enter into mutually beneficial business arrangements, eliminating unnecessary delays and additional expenses and compromises in the quality of dental services for patients. Since the dental and denturist professions are highly interrelated, it only makes sense to create for patients a seamless service environment. Such business alliances in Washington State have proven to be mutually beneficial and to improve service quality and patient satisfaction. There certainly is no reason to limit efforts to create more cooperation within the dental community and better service for consumers. Besides preventing denturists from developing joint business arrangements with dentists, Senate Bill 390 also gives dentists licensed by the Board of Dentistry unrestricted control of every aspect of a dental clinic or business. Even if denturists were allowed to jointly own a dental business, a dentist would have control of the denturist practice within the business. Senate Bill 390 goes against the expressed intent of Measure 24, and we strongly urge your opposition to Senate Bill 390. I'd like to add to that that our focus with the Senior Coalition, of course, is for seniors and containment of costs. And unfortunately, this past week has only proven to me, number one, that seniors are up for grab, and number two, that the federal government has declared war on seniors as well as the state of Oregon. Last week, the House voted to cut Medicaid by $92 billion. Now they want to cut Medicare by $270 billion. And I just received a notice that my Plan B copayment for Medicare is going to go up 12% to $66 a month. That's the bad news. The good news is that the dentures, the bill that exists as it is today, is not going to cost seniors any money. On the contrary, it's going to save up to 50% and millions of dollars. I respectfully urge you to join us in opposition to Senate Bill 390. Thank you very much.
Vance, Jane.
Yeah. Okay. Why don't we wait a little bit here till we get some?
I have some questions that I need to. There seems to be three sides to this argument.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
Reminds me of my cousin sitting on the car hood of his dad's car, and he said, "You know," he says, "there's three ways. There's this way, there's that way, and this way." And I think we miss a half a dozen of them in the process. But he was pretty good for a three-year-old. Dr. Short, Ronald Short, from the Oregon Board of Dentistry. Come over 100 miles, you're a dedicated person.
Chair Fisher and members of the committee, the testimony that I would present is pretty much included in the letter that you have from Joanne Bones, our executive secretary, and from the handouts that you've just received, which I think is pretty much a duplicate of that. In respect for our time, I want to go over the entire testimony. We are in favor of Senate Bill 390. The Board of Dentistry would support that. There is one issue with the new bill, Senate 2964, which is an addition to Senate Bill 390, and that's regard to a minority ownership of dental practices. And we feel that dentists should be allowed to enter into business arrangements with non-dentists that allow the non-dentist to own a minority share of the business. And I realize that Senate Bill 2964 is not here. We'd heard that there might be an amendment to 390 offered. And if such an amendment were offered, the Board of Dentistry would be in support of that, probably. However, we would be more comfortable with a 25% minority ownership than with a 49%. Other than that, where the other parts of Senate Bill 390 we are comfortable with. Okay. Any questions?
Senator Morrison.
Thank you. Suddenly there's a seems to be a turf battle looming here between dentist and denturist. Aside from that, the ownership could be anybody could be a 25% owner of a dentist or 49% owner. We're not talking specifics, right? In terms of ownership, if you favor, say, 25% ownership, you favor it across the board. There are no restrictions on who can be a 25% owner, is what you're saying.
Chair Fisher and Senator Morissette, that would be correct.
Okay.
And I'm in reference to a turf battle on the committee that I was on with respect to the last gentleman's testimony. I don't remember any issue ever being brought up about trying to restrict anything with a denturist or anything as far as the discussion on what's now Senate Bill 390. I don't recall anything like that during the discussion of those meetings.
Okay. Thank you.
We're a little bit limited in our time, so I'm going to try to hurry this up. We've got several people that wish to speak. Some would be a little bit easier to get here than others. We've got a Joseph, I believe it is. I can't pronounce the last name. I'm going to guess that even as I can do pretty good on work projects with my hands and eye coordination, doesn't have anything to do with my penmanship, but I can't read your last name.
May I have a seat?
Yes, certainly. Come up here and testify. Thank you, Dr. Short.
Thank you very much, sir.
Appreciate your coming a long ways to give your support to Senate Bill 3.
I make the trip quite a few times.
Thank you, Chair Fisher and the committee, for hearing my remarks. My name is Joe Lubicich. That's how you say my last name. And I am currently a third-year dental student up at OHSU, and I'm also the president of the All Hill Council. That's what we call our student body government up there. And I am here today to speak strongly in favor of Bill 390. And the perspective I'd like to give you is from the patient's perspective, from hearing everybody, there's so many different angles and I want to divvy things up, and it's hard to even tell the difference. And so the way I'm approaching this is, you know, what is best for the patient? When I see patients up at the school, it's usually a two- or a three-way relationship. It's me, the patient, sometimes insurance if the patient is fortunate enough to have insurance. And that at times is a blessing, other times it's hard to work with. If we are to allow non-dentist ownership, I think that adds a whole other dynamic here of someone involved that potentially is an obstruction to the care that we can provide. The main difference is that when I graduate next year, I'm also one of Senator Burdick's constituents. I'm not sure if she's had a chance to attend a graduation up there, but I stand up and I pledge to place the patient's interest above my own and everything else. I think that's the key difference there. I'm the advocate for the patient there. And if we step in and take away from the dentist's control to practice, which it would do if there is any level of patient ownership, that compromises the patient-doctor relationship. I know in medicine, which everyone knows, that very few people are pleased with the current state of how the whole system works. It's 49%. And there are relationships that I think that we cannot compromise in a legal profession. We have the attorney-client relationship, the physician-patient relationship, and then me as a dentist and my patient's relationship. And I think that if we do allow non-dentist ownership, that compromises my ability to advocate for the patient. We have external influences and other factors at work here. If you have any questions, I'll be happy to entertain those.
Thank you very much for taking time off from your studies here to come. Thank you.
I'm pleased to do it. Yes. Thank you.
And good luck to you. And another year to go after this.
Hopefully June of 2004, I'll be graduating.
Well,
thank you very much.
Echo that hope. Dr. Stearns.
Chair Fisher and committee members, thank you for your time. My name is Clayton Stearns, and I'm a practicing dental specialist here in Salem. I'm the past president of the Oregon Dental Association and a past president of the Oregon Board of Dentistry. And I speak today in favor of Senate Bill 390 as it is, and I wish to speak in opposition to any amendments that provide for any percentage of non-dentist ownership of dental practices. During my term on the Oregon Board of Dentistry, several questions were raised about ownership of dental practices that resulted in the board requesting clarification of the law through an attorney general's opinion. This opinion pointed out that Oregon's law was so restrictive that the Oregon Board of Dentistry, because at that time it was past time for presenting legislative proposals, asked the Oregon Dental Association, which represents more than 75% of the practicing dentists in the state, to come forward with a proposal that addressed the inequities. This was done in our last legislative session. After testimony, the legislature asked if interested parties could work together to work out differences. SB 390 represents resolution of all these differences with the exception of non-dentist ownership. The vast majority of practicing dentists have gone on record against any percentage of non-dentist licensee ownership of dental practices. Why? There's no provision for patient protection. The Oregon Board of Dentistry has no jurisdiction over non-licensees. A dentist, if he or she misbehaves, could lose their license, which represents 8 to 10 years of training. There is no comparable punishment for someone who would invest in a dental practice who might engage in activities that might harm patients.
Doctor, could I ask you to kind of sum up what we're doing here? We're pushed to another committee supposed to have this room at 3 o'clock.
In the interest of time, sir, I would gladly let you read that and answer any questions that I might be able to answer.
But you have a very well thought out argument here. You have a question? I want to apologize to folks for not being able to get this done, but I don't have a luxury. I'd be more than happy to sit here for a while this afternoon and allow everyone to testify. Doug, you and Russ, I'm sure, can make it at another date, and also Barney. Apologize for that. Four members of the Denturist Association, we're just going to have to wait and have you at the next session is all I know what to do here, because we've got to scram out and vamoose out of this room. So with that, I thank you, Doctor, and I apologize for cutting you a bit short there, but you have left a good testimony for us here.
So we're done.
We're done. I'm going to close the public hearing and adjourn the committee.